I want to start with Maimonides' class on Thursdays. We made a lot of references to abortion as a helpful way to think through some of these issues. And I want to make a parallel move here. So I'll start with the abortion analog and then bring it back to today. Because there's something that we're going to be doing that's kind of methodologically different in today's source sheet, as you'll see. There's something that is off about, there's something that's true, but there's also something that's off about the kind of discourse you probably have seen and heard, maybe participated in, that like Judaism is good on abortion, whatever that means to you, whatever you think position on abortion should be, you know, over the last couple of, Judaism has it. And there's a lot of different ways to interrogate that, but I think the most significant one is to look back at Blue Greenberg, one of the founding Jewish feminists, writings in the 70s and early 80s, where Blue did not think that the Jewish tradition was that great on abortion. And in fact, a lot of our rereading of Jewish tradition and abortion, our current reading is due to a feminist rereading. And I'm trying to bring this out methodologically because I think there's a danger of an element of gaslighting in how we, to use a term that kids use a lot these days, narrate the Jewish tradition, right? No such thing. So Sarah, right, right, these are good points, right? There's no such thing as bodily autonomy. You know, I'm not so sure about the first point, Sarah, because there's a lot of stuff. I don't know if you've read any of Javi Karkowski's work in The Atlantic about how the early, you know, kind of a lot of the pre-ultrasound language for abortion is bringing on a late period. And there actually is a lot in the Talmud about that, different things to drink to bring on a late period. There's stuff that probably actually is early abortion. And then certainly in the medieval period, there's this really harrowing account of women who in Egypt, 15th century, who were, childbirth was so dangerous that they would, on signs of pregnancy, like beat their bellies to try to bring on an early miscarriage. And really interesting question comes to the Radbaz, the leading rabbinic figure, about whether that's permitted and also about whether it's breaking Shabbos. If you wholeheartedly endorse or even want to take a stance that everything is totally great in the tradition as we inherited it pre-1960, it becomes difficult to read the early Jewish feminists in the 70s who didn't think that everything was right in the tradition. And the reason I'm bringing that up here, I think there's kind of really interesting writing on this vis-a-vis abortion. I'm trying to do a little bit before Rosh Hashanah to kind of add a chapter to it. And specifically the kind of theological framing of coercive pregnancy, God forbid. The reason I'm bringing up here is that the methodology so far of this course has been what I will call hafokh ba v'hafokh ba dekula ba, right? As Ben Bogbog says in Mishnah Avot, turn it and turn it for everything is in it. You know, but at the very minimum, not everyone. And what I've been trying to say, right, is you, like I, have doubts or have complicated feelings and thoughts about revelation, about God's proximity, trustworthiness, et cetera, about the afterlife. You know, the rabbis are right there with you. The Talmud is right there with you, right? We haven't been looking in the right place. We haven't been centering the right text, but if you look hard and well enough, you'll find it. And that's like great. And it's great as far as it goes. The problem is sometimes it doesn't go far enough. And so what I want to do today is to try to take a step beyond, because there are certain types of human beings who are not represented in the Talmud. And I think that that is critical. And maybe it's dumb and obvious as I say that, but I want to draw a specific one that a type of human being that I am. So I will tell this story. This is actually a forthcoming book chapter of mine. The story goes like this. I started learning Talmud circa 2001 and I loved it. And I had a great like 13 year run. And I just was like unproblematically an apprentice of Chazal. I wanted to be like them. I was like them. And then our older son, Raphael, was born late spring of 2014. And I went back to teaching Talmud at Hadar that summer, and it didn't go as well. And the reason it didn't go as well is I was hit by the, you know, every time I was away, he was a little tiny baby, right? I couldn't, my mind wasn't really where I was. It was with him. I felt like the most important part of my life was happening wherever he was. And when I was in a different place, the most important part of my life was happening not where I was. And I realized that every single deathbed scene in the Talmud, the rabbis are surrounded by their students and not their children. And except for the one exception that proves the rule is Rabbi Eliezer's deathbed scene where his son Hyrcanus is there, but he turns out to be an embarrassingly bad student. His father rebukes him and kicks him out. And it was like, I condemn the rabbis. Like, I think that they were wrong. It's just like, that wasn't the life I wanted. It wasn't the life I felt like I could live anymore. I was like, I love all you students at Hadar, but like, you know, when my time comes to go to Shemaim, I don't want you guys around. And that like configuration of priorities was just a different type of being a person. You know, I remember there's this kind of famous quip from a Mexican nun that Aristotle would have been a better philosopher if he'd washed more dishes. And I remember when I had a little baby and my friend Yoni Raffman, who's a Jewish philosopher, had a baby, we were walking our babies at evening time in Riverdale that summer. And he said, you know, I think Hegel would have been a better philosopher if he'd changed more diapers. Might have been a little more grounded. And I was having some kind of similar thoughts. You know, I don't know if people know there's a Mishnah and a vote. You know, and the question here, right, is not like, did the rabbis change diapers? I mean, I think they probably didn't change. Most of them didn't change many diapers, but that's a little beside the point. The question is how significant they thought diaper changing was. Very significant. You know, the Mishnah in Bava Metzia that says you come across a lost object belonging to your father and a lost object belonging to your teacher. Who takes precedence? Your teacher takes precedence because your father just brought you into this world, but your teacher brings you into the world, life of the world to come. Right, so even to the extent the rabbis are doing caring work, they're not valuing it, particularly they're devaluing it in favor of their teaching work. They're devaluing the relationship to their fathers vis-a-vis the relationship to their teachers, and they're devaluing their own roles as fathers compared to their own roles as teachers. Does that make sense? It's not so much about just what work you're doing, it's about how you think about it, how you feel your way through it. And so the claim I'm going to make, and I mean, I'm not the first person to make this, is that the people who are very deeply embedded in and shaped by caring work are not people who are reflected in the Talmud, not voices we have in the Talmud. And if we, and when we center those voices, we have little glimpses of them here and there. That's Elijah behind me. That Rafael's at summer camp building things at Eli Whitney camp. This is Elijah, whose babysitter didn't show up today. He's watching Minecraft videos on YouTube, in case you're wondering. I don't really understand what Minecraft is, but the kids really like it. It seems harmless. If you know otherwise, please tell me. So that's the claim. And that when you incorporate that, when you inhabit that kind of voice, it has revolutionary potential. And in case, I know I mentioned a lot of books. I'll probably mention a lot more on this. But the book, I just want to share this because it's so arresting. There's a lot of books. The genre here, kind of in the, you know, the kind of contemporary Western tradition, is called care ethics. And the basic idea, intuition behind care ethics is like, you know, we assume that ethics are like, okay, you're utilitarian, like greatest for the greatest number, you're a Kantian, you think about duty. Well, it's like, what would happen if you thought about like the capacity to do caring work as the kind of basic ethical thing, right? One interesting thing, for example, is that utilitarianism, Kantianism, contractualism, all assume that the basic form of ethics is about making decisions. Do I save this one person or these five people? Do I save this one person I'm close to or these two people I don't know? Do I sacrifice one life to improve 1,000 lives? I have a decision to make. Care ethics points out or observes that a lot of being a good person involves cultivating skills, the capacity to notice when someone is sick and to care for them, the capacity to prepare a nutritious meal for people with diverse dietary restrictions. Right, the capacity to remember birthdays and get good, right? Those aren't like, should you do this or that? It's like becoming a person who can make, you know, can make the world better for others. So there's a lot of good writing, especially from the 70s and 80s on this. And my favorite book, and I think it's just an amazing book, is called Love's Labor by Eva Feder Kitay, K-I-T-T-A-Y. And I'll just share because I think it's such an arresting image. Kitay writes about how she has this great line. She says, you know, and there are other people who have written on this also, but, you know, the kind of founding texts of Western philosophy, right, assume, and Hobbes is explicit about this, that all human beings they're analyzing are independent. They can meet their own needs on their own. And Hobbes says, because it's too complicated to get in all these relationships, What I'm going to assume is you have a group of people who have no pre-existing relationships and they enter into a social contract. Right? And so Kate points out that all human beings are sometimes dependent and some human beings are always dependent. And she actually has two children, one of whom kind of took a normal developmental trajectory and one of whom had a severe and pervasive developmental disability and was forever dependent on the care of others. She writes very movingly about this. And then her first full chapter is called Another Child's Mother. I'm sorry, Another Mother's Child. And she talks about how her mother, who was raised in a very traditional way and mothered in a very traditional way, whenever her mother felt the need and the ability to put her own needs before that of husband or children, would sigh and say, after all, I'm another mother's child too. And it was, her framework was how a person becomes a moral being is by having been invested in care by a parent. Right? It's not that each of us has our own divine spark inside, but that we're actually the recipients of a tradition of caring that we are then passing on. And the way that we get in touch with our own value is to remember that there was someone else prior who placed us before themselves. And that's what gives us the opportunity and sometimes the duty to place ourselves before others. Right? It's a fundamental revolution in the Western tradition about how you might see a person. So anyways, there's a really interesting tradition of care ethics that goes in a lot of directions. In some ways, the idea of this class, which I feel a little bad because we have so much amazing Torah to look at, I was taking this long as an introduction, is from my own experience and that of, first moral Feld, as we'll see, because I think it's important to start with the kind of the Jewish feminist tradition here, on what has been heretofore missing in the Torah, if that makes sense, and what the feminism actually and care ethics possess as a potentially revelatory potential to add a new chapter to the Torah.
Okay. Merle Feld, we all stood together for Rachel Adler. My brother and I were at Sinai. He kept a journal of what he saw, of what he heard, of what it all meant to him. I wish I had such a record of what happened to me there. It seems like every time I want to write, I can't. I'm always holding a baby, one of my own or one of a friend, always holding a baby so my hands are never free to write things down. And then as time passes, the particulars, the heart data, the who, what, when, where, why, slip away from me, and all I'm left with is the feeling. But feelings are just sounds, the vowel barking of a mute. My brother is so sure of what he heard. After all, he's got a record of it, consonant after consonant after consonant. If we remember it together, we could recreate holy time, sparks flying.
Okay. Thank you. You read that really beautifully. So there's so much, such a beautiful one. I want to say, Merle Feld was, I did a kind of creative writing process with her through rabbinical school and for many years, actually on the board of her organization, Derech, really like a deeply humane, beautiful human being and soul. And I'm honored to teach some of her Torah here. And so the picture I want to give, and there's so much to say about this poem, but the thing I want to point out is that caring work and Torah have a paradoxical relationship with each other, right? On the one hand, caring work makes Torah impossible. One doesn't have the time, doesn't have the free hands to write. One doesn't have, as Virginia Woolf put it, a room of one's own. So you're sharing it with a nursing baby. And to care not just for one's own baby, but to be embedded in a network of caring, right? To be able to care for others by caring for their children, right? Further takes you away. And so in that sense, one can't both study Torah and be deeply engaged in caring. And yet, the image at the end is critical, right? The uncaring brother, and that means not someone who doesn't care, but someone who's not engaged in caring work, all only has consonants. And Feld is playing here at the end with the image of laning Torah in Shul, which is a reenactment of Sinai, where the consonants sit there and are mute without the vowels. And someone works over the course of a week to learn, to engrave those patterns on their mind so they can sing them aloud for others in real time, not just there being the timeless Torah, but that the sparks fly, the recreation of holy time occurs. And in this sense, caring, the experiences of caring work are necessary for Torah, right? One actually doesn't have Torah, one just has consonants if one isn't the person who's shaped by caring work. And I just also want to point out that the last line of Feld's poem is in the subjunctive, right? If we remembered it together, right? It's not about a past. She's pointing out, I think correctly, that this type of voice in Torah hasn't yet occurred or hadn't yet occurred when she wrote it. Because this is the very beginning, really, of Jewish feminist writing. That there is something unrealized in the Torah. You know, Plaskow put in Standing Again at Sinai puts this very starkly. She says, you know, there's something threatening, but also something liberating about feminism and Judaism, because it opens up the possibility that we've never yet had Judaism. We've only ever had male Judaism. Real Judaism is as of yet unrealized in the world. It's an amazing claim. And there's something similar held here. Ever since Sinai, never had it again. We've only had partial, silent, unfeeling restorations of it. Ooh, that's big. And I think Feld is right, as you'll see. So I just want to pause and give people an opportunity to post in the chat here. I mean, this is like not a small claim. And it may deeply resonate. There may be something that feels true. And there may be something that's like, makes you really upset. And so I just want to give a second for people to post in the chat what you're thinking and feeling at this stage. Yeah, so good. So great. Gilligan's work is often critiqued. I'm glad you brought it up, right? It's a brilliant, amazing piece of writing. The main reason it's critiqued, I don't know if people know this, is so Gilligan's she's still even an education professor at Harvard, and she's never released the data for anyone else to look at for that book. And people are skeptical. There's other books. I'll put a few in the chat that are very important. Nell Noddings has a book, Caring, which is really important. There's a bunch of these, and they have, you know, it's a really interesting thing. Just so people know, I'll put in the chat here, the volume that's coming out is called Care Ethics in Religious and Spiritual Traditions. Okay. Whew, we'll get to that hopefully at the end, but I think it's just a little bit different than the patriarch. So watch this though. Okay, this is an amazing, amazing midrash. Follow the Holy Blessed One's attributes. God clothes the naked. As it is written, the Lord God made leather clothing for the earthling, that's Adam and his wife, and clothed them. So you too clothe the naked. The Blessed Holy One visited the sick. As it is written, God appeared to him, Abraham, near Mamre's grove. This is Abraham 3 days after his circumcision. So you too visit the sick. The Blessed Holy One comforted mourners. It is written, after Abraham's death, Hashem blessed Yitzchak, which is seen here as the Komav Elin, visiting him during its Shiva. So you too comfort mourners. The Blessed Holy One buried the dead. As it is written, and Hashem buried Moshe in the valley, the very end of the Torah. So you too bury the dead. So scroll down just a little bit. Rabbi Simlai taught, the Torah's begins and ends are in Gemilut Chasadim, which I'm not going to translate for a moment. The Torah's beginnings are in Gemilut Chasadim, as it says, the Lord God made leather clothing for the earth and his wife and clothed them. And the Torah's ends are in Gemilut Chasadim, as it says, and God buried Moses in the valley. Wow. Now, why am I saying wow? Because if you were to take an intro to Bible class, and one of the options for the final essay was to say, characterize God, write a 15 to 5-page word essay on the character of God in the Bible. And you said, okay, you know who God in the Bible is? God cares for the sick, visits the naked, clothes the naked, buries the dead. You would fail. Because an accurate reading of God in the Bible, God avenges and redeems Israel, punishes the guilty, maybe heals the sick in certain moments, prosecutes Israel's wars, performs miracles, creates the world, gets angry a lot, is jealous, right? Like that's what the paper you would write. So the first thing I would point is, this is what Harold Bloom of Blessed Memory called a strong reading, right? You don't get to this midrash from the Sota, in Sota by saying, oh, I'm just going to add up the descriptions of God, and whichever are the four that have the most in the Bible, that's who God is. Or a stronger way of saying is your theological data are not coming exclusively, and in some sense, not even primarily from the Bible. Whoever wrote this midrash is, I want to suggest, is like, when I something like this, when I reflect back on my life, where am I surest that God has been present? Visiting the sick, being visited when I was sick, clothing the naked, or having people bring clothes to me when I didn't have any. Comforting mourners, being comforted when I was in mourning, and burying the dead. And those experiences were so epistemically formative, as in they shaped the way how I know what I know, that then they shape how I read the Bible. Does that make sense? Now, I want to tell you, have your hand up. I want to get you in a second. I want to point out, now, I didn't translate Camilo Castaneda because in my earlier phase, before I made the kind of Feldian move, I was like, the right way to translate Gemilu Chasadim is caring work. It's an amazing claim, right? The Torah begins and ends in caring work. And these are types of caring work. But here's the problem. No one has ever had to give up their career because they were visiting the sick. Right? No one has ever had their life derailed because they were clothing the naked. These are things you can do as a volunteer activity. They're things that might take a few days out of your life, but they don't occupy a decade of your best years. They're not like my grandmother, whose academic, may she rest in peace, whose academic career was destroyed because she cared for her mother-in-law with dementia for a decade. Right? They're not like what some people, you know, primarily women, but not exclusively, you know, give up in careers for participating in networks of care, caring for aging parents, caring for children, themselves undergoing, you know, sickness. There's an intensity of caring work, and I'm specifically taking parents and children, which is not listed here. And I want to suggest that that's not a coincidence, and the tradition does not have a term for that type of intensive work that can shape a decade or more of one's life, and therefore one's whole life. So what I'm describing, Gemilu Chasadim, I think is correctly translated as the type of caring work you can step into and out of without disrupting your major commitments. And this midrash gets a huge amount of credit for going that far, but it also can't go and doesn't go further. Does that make sense? Right? It was actually my friend, Yehuda Koren, who pointed out as a Talmud professor in Israel. Right? There's always something in classification, what gets terms, right? We actually have a term, Gemilu Chasadim, right? The Talmud will say, welcoming a bride, you know, burying the dead overrides Torah study. Because we have a category, Gemilu Chasadim, and we can compare it to Talmud Torah, and it supersedes. We don't even have a category for what I described, spending every waking moment caring for an aging parent or a dependent child. And therefore, we can't have an articulation of whether that overrides one's own Torah study or other things. I'll share one from my mother when she was an academic. She was at Georgetown. And what I'm going to try to suggest is how these conflicts, right? You can get the image of always falling a half day behind is so apt, I think, can occur not just between the professional sphere and the personal sphere, but even within the professional sphere. At Georgetown, there was some award. It was like, you know, the old professor and Mrs. So-and-so award for excellence in teaching in junior faculty. It was for the best teacher, it was untenured faculty, but the faculty had a different name for it, which was the kiss of death, because no one who'd ever gotten it, that teaching award had gotten tenure. Because if you devoted the time and mental energy to being an excellent teacher, really reading your 19-year-old's essays and helping them grow as writers and thinkers, and then as human beings, because they would come and sit in your office and grow, you wouldn't have time to publish the great work. And the tenure committee didn't really care. And so what I'm trying to suggest is that this distinction is so helpful that it, you know, occurs on different levels. And we're going to see another source now that will push in this direction. So the spiritual reason block. Thank you for saying it to make sense. So now we're going to look at another Agadah, which does reflect this just within a kind of professional register, as you'll see. And it's in the long Bikur Cholim Sugya. There's a long Sugya in Nedarim about visiting the sick. So I want to start now actually at the quotes that are on the line he said to them. Okay, we'll zoom out in a second, but this is a story in a story. Okay, didn't it happen? Try to ignore what's before. Didn't it happen that one of Rabbi Akiva's students who became ill, and none of the sages went in to visit him? Okay, so you have a picture here of Rabbi Akiva's academy. Maybe this is the 24,000 students or pairs of students who didn't respect each other, right? It's academy, people are learning. When you get sick and you can't come, you don't matter anymore because life is in the baby trash. And the people who matter are there, we're producing Torah. No one went to visit him. Rabbi Akiva came in to visit him. Interestingly, Rabbi Akiva it's his academy, but he's actually behaving differently than his students. He has failed to teach them something that he knows, right? Which is when your colleague or student is sick, you go visit, you put down your books and you go visit them. Rabbi Akiva knows that, his students don't. And because of that, because Rabbi Akiva was there, they cleaned and arranged things from the students. The caretaker gave better work. You know, there's lots of data about this, right? When people go to doctor's appointments with someone accompanying them, they get better care, right? Because the staff pay better attention to you. He lived, and the student said, Rabbi, you brought me life, or maybe Hechitani, maybe you resurrected me. Rabbi Akiva went out from the students' chambers and taught anyone who does not visit the sick, it is as if he has spilled blood. And don't scroll down. So what I want you to see here, just this moment, so Rabbi Akiva does this caring work, the Gemilut Chasadim, the limited caring work, right? He goes in and he comes out. And look at the spatial dimension, right? He comes into the student's room and he leaves it. That's the center place. And that is the place where Torah is generated. Right, all the people studying in the Beit Midrash who are deciding not to visit the sick in order to learn Torah are not generating Torah. Rabbi Akiva, who puts down the books to visit the sick students, and Dubikor Kolim comes out, does generate Torah. Not in the Beit Midrash, which we find out is so devoted to Torah that's turned it into an idol. Right, ultimate value, not a means to the ends of human life. But doing caring work, just like Feld said, right, you have to step out of the Beit Midrash to do caring work in order to generate Torah. It's an amazing moment, right? Rabbi Akiva creates a new midrash. But watch this. Now let's go back up to the top. So Rabbi Akiva is, right, a third generation Tana, around the year 127, raised in the Bar Kokhba rebellion, 130. Rav Helbo, now we're in like second generation mourning. We're about a century later. Okay, 100 years later. Rav Helbo was sick. Rav Kahana went out in the Beit Midrash. Rav Helbo is ill. No one came. Everyone looks up, they hear Rav Helbo's, and they're like, oh, that's too bad. I have a Mishnah to figure out. I hope he feels better. I'll think of him when I daven in. He, Rav Kahana, said to everyone, didn't it happen that one of Rabbi Akiva's students, dot, dot, dot. So what we see here now is that Rabbi Akiva attempted and failed to create an intervention in the culture of the Beit Midrash. Right? He, Rabbi Akiva, felt like an outlier in his own Beit Midrash because he was more devoted. He was devoted to Torah. That's why he ran a Beit Midrash. But you understood that as a part of that, you need to engage in even this limited type of caring work. And he attempted to instill that lesson. And we see that he failed because a century later, even when the story is known, its lessons are not taken to heart. This is the same Beit Midrash functionally as Rabbi Akiva's students a century earlier, who, when people fall sick, just get left by the wayside as the caravan of Torah moves on. And I want to point out here that I think there are actually three types of characters who do activity. There's the students who just keep studying, right? They're the equivalent in our first text of the God is jealous, does war. You know, you just learn who God is from the text. Then we have Rabbi Akiva, who's like the author of the previous Midrash. He's like, you also need to engage in this limited type of caring work in order to know who God is, in order to really have Torah. But there's a third type of agent here, who's the people who clean and care for the sick student who don't have a voice. And my suggestion is, right, these are the people who are engaged in the intensive caring work that doesn't have a name in the previous sugya, in Sota. And their silence here means that Rabbi Akiva can't really authentically transmit this message because it's not really his message. There's someone who more authentically embodies it, the caring work, and it's not him. Someone who's made real sacrifices to engage in caring work. And the parallel here, and if you, I can send the PDF if you're interested, but in the essay, this is actually very parallel to a feminist Marxist movement where they say, okay, you know, there's a Marxist move that workers embody, understand real labor more than capitalists. And the feminist Marxist move is like, okay, but like the workers' wives, because classically the Marxist account is masculine, understand care and work even better than the workers. And a Marxist revolution will never really succeed because it's actually alienated from and silences. Marxists generally have not been good on feminism, male Marxists and socialist parties. The people who are doing real care and work, but to complete Marxism is to take it all the way to a feminist Marxism that talks about caring work. And that's the same move suggestion here in this sugya. Right. So that's right. Also Rabbi Akiva, right? What does he do? He's away from his wife. It's a heartbreaking story. So what I hope you feel in these two texts is this tripartite set of options, that there's a purely textual tradition. In Sota, it's just you read God off the pages of the Torah, and here it's you just keep studying no matter what. Then there's a deviation from it that's not just possible, but actually elevated, that's centering this limited type of caring work in Gemilut Chasadim. Says that's who God is, and that's what you need to do to be actually a real student of Torah. And then there's a more intensive caring work, which is marginalized, literally. We don't have a voice of it. It's not given a name. It's not valorized as being God's image or as necessary for Torah. And that's precisely the type of caring work that Merle Feld felt was necessary for Torah, kind of like we've seen suggest here, but even more intensively, but also incompatible with Torah as it's been lived in practice. And so what I'm trying to suggest is, just like there's a new revelatory potential that Rabbi Akiva and the Gemara and Sota find by limited caring work, there's a yet greater revelatory potential by bringing in voices of people who devoted decades to their lives to full in caring work. I mean, and I don't really count myself on that. I took 4 months of parental leave with each child we've had. So I've had many months, but, you know, not a full year, not decades. But I can see that. And I can appreciate it. And I have for some stretch of time lived a life where it was all about, you know, children's doctor's appointments and school appointments and parent-teacher conferences, like not a full life, not caring for me, but like some, I've had a taste of it and I love it. And I felt disappointed that our rabbis of blessed memory weren't marked by this type of caring work and it didn't shape who they were as rabbis. That makes sense. Now we're going to look at two of the only, these are really the only two agadot that I'm aware of that take intensive involvement with childbearing as theologically central. And we're going to see they both do that, but they go in opposite directions. One will remake God in that image, which is very compelling, will narrate God in that image. And the other will use that intensive child-centered image to critique a picture of God, challenge a picture of God, which starts to get us where Ted was thinking about from RSC. Okay, so this is from Dvarim Rabbah. That'll become significant. The other one's from Shemot Rabbah, and I'll say a word about that as we get to the end. Okay. Rivava ketzema chasede netati. Right, I made you grow like the grass of the fields. This verse from Ezekiel, which is about the Exodus, it seems, and is in some versions of the Haggadah. When Pharaoh decreed that all newborn boys would be cast into the sea, what did the women do? When a Jewish woman felt contractions beginning, she would go out to give birth in a field. There was less of the police state was less in place. When she had given birth, she would look upward and say, You, God, said, be fruitful and multiply. I've done my part, now you do yours. It's amazing, chutzpah. So part of there's already something fun happening here. You have to be a little inside. The majority opinion is that women aren't commanded to be fruitful and multiply. This is already taking up a minority opinion and assertion of agency. Okay. I'm thinking, what are you going to do now, God? So what would the Egyptians do? So when the Egyptians saw the Jewish women going out to the field to give birth there, they would watch them from a distance. They say, okay, she's going to give birth, then we'll go kill the baby, right? Once the Jewish woman had given birth and returned to the city, the Egyptians would pick up rocks and go to kill the babies. It was a horrific image, giving up your baby here. But the infants would be swallowed up in the fields and then would reappear far away. Then they pop up over in that corner of the field, and the Egyptians run after them, only to be swallowed up again and reappear elsewhere again and again until the Egyptians got tired and went away. So this is a little bit of like Benny Hill type slapstick comedy, right? The Egyptians are getting tired, running around there. They're like, my shift is over. Got to go get donuts. leave, right? And the baby, okay, so the baby survived this first threat, but now it's alone in a field, which is not a good way for a human baby to be. So, and how did the children live in the fields? Rabbi Levi said the Holy One, Blessed One, would assign two angels to each one to wash her and one to clothe her. And he nursed and anointed them, right? So the angels washing clothes, but God is nursing the babies. As it says, he nursed you with honey from the rock. And I washed you with water and clothed you in garments. I'm sorry, it should say they nursed and anointed them, right? Okay. Rabbi Chiya the Great said, scroll down a little bit. It wasn't the angels who did that, rather the Holy Blessed One himself. As it says, I washed you. Had it says, I caused you to be washed, I'm sorry for the translation, with the yud and a hefiel, I would have thought that perhaps it was by an angel. But since it says, I washed you and not an angel, just like God, right? May the name of the Holy One be blessed, since he himself cared for me. So here we have a distinction, right? Which is a more transcendent picture of God? God who's in there changing diapers, or God who has someone to do that? So we can understand or believe. Now we're going to see that Rabbi Chiya the Great is correct, that it was God doing the caring. So if you could scroll down to the next paragraph, Esther, probably going to cry because I always cry when I read this. Okay. The babies grew in the fields like grass. And after they grew, they returned to their homes in flocks. This is what Yechezkel said. You grew like the grass of the field. How did they know which home was their family's? Really good question, right? They were born in the field. They lived there. They never met their parents. How do they know which home is theirs? The Holy Blessed One accompanied them, pointed each and every one to his parents' home and said, call your father this and your mother that. The babies don't even know their parents' names. The children would say to their mothers, don't you remember when you gave birth to me on this day in that field 5 months? Or all the manuscripts say months, but years is a much more, the baby's walking, they're talking, you know, they seem more like a five-year-old Elijah back here ago. And she would ask him, who raised you? And he would say, a special, handsome young man, unlike anyone else. He brought me here and he's right outside. She would, oh, that's good. But she would say to him, and they would go outside and search all the alleyways and everywhere, but they couldn't find him. When they came to the sea, they saw him, the babies, at the splitting of the sea. And they pointed him out to their mothers with their fingers and said to them, this is my God, and I will honor him. This is the one who raised me. Amazing. So we could turn off the screen share for a sec. So this is an incredible midrash, right? And then somehow it fulfills, but also, I'm just reading Sherry's comment here. Exactly, the memories we pass on. And so what I want, God here is depicted as a caring figure. And I mean, just such a beautiful, haunting image. But the thing I want to just point out methodologically is there are two really significant moments that are easy to pass up, which are allusions to the Song of Songs. One, the special, beautiful, handsome young man, like there's no other. And also the searching through the alleyways. And what's happening here is something incredible, which is the image of the erotic search for God. And eros, I just mean in the basic sense of being attracted to, is not peer-to-peer romance, but children seeking out their parents. Right? And I don't know if you have memories of this phase from your childhood, or if you have children in the memory, right? Like when your children are little, like even littler than Elijah, you know, like 2, 3, like they just like can't understand why you're leaving them every day, why you go to the office. And they like, they're so happy when you come back, like out of their gourds happy. And the idea is to use that realm of experience to, as the framework for white human beings relate to God, not a romantic one. And as far as I know, this is the only text. For, you know, we talk a lot about God as father, being a volcano, but this is really one of the only kind of classical text I can think of that really tries to center the child's experience of searching for, finding, losing, reclaiming the one who cares for them and loves them as what religious life is like. Does that make sense? And that's the key to its pathos. I just, the first year of the Ateretz Fee Prize, Akiva Mattinson won for us analyzing the set of Midrashim that talk about God either as a husband or a father who has left and gone across the sea to a place that we can't go and don't know. Oh, there you go. Just read it. Amazing. I mean, it's been years since I want to go back and read it now. So I think it's very closely connected. Okay. Okay, I want to set the scene a little bit for it, which this is because it's there's one aspect of this midrash that's just filling in the holes. And what I mean by that, this midrash occurs. There's a textual problem in the Torah. So at the announcement of the seventh plague, hail, Moses is at this point 6 for 6. And the Torah says some Egyptians believed Moses, and so they brought their slaves and cattle indoors to protect them from the hail, and some didn't believe Moses, and their slaves and cattle were outdoors, and the hail came and worked out. Now, at the announcement of the 10th plague, the death of the firstborn, Moses is 9 for 9. And he announces, right, the Egyptian firstborn will be killed, the Israelite firstborn won't. Moses is 9 for 9, and the stakes are higher. So if at the 7th plague, some of the Egyptians did things to try to mitigate effects or protect their property, all the more so wouldn't they at the 10th plague? When Moses said, so here we go, watch the Midrash go, I will smite all the firstborn. Some of the Egyptians were afraid and some weren't. Those, just like with the seventh plague, those who were afraid brought their firstborn to an Israelite and said, please, I beg you, take him in with you for the night. I just want you to imagine this scene, right? Egyptian grandparents, it's 10 p.m. They know what's coming at midnight. And they knock on their Israelite neighbor's doors. And you could imagine some of them are holding little tiny babies, right, saying, please protect my child. Some of them are bringing 15-year-olds who maybe have slept over in the Israelites, and their kids played together. I mean, you can just imagine the scene, right? Like, what do the Israelite neighbors do? This is Merle Fells, right? Okay, we've held these babies. You know, what do you do? Do you shut your door? Or do you say, please bring your child in? You know, we have a sleeping bag for them. It's incredible. And like, you know, this question has always been there. Whenever I was asking, and I think it's David Arnau who showed this midrash. Okay, so go back to the screen share. When midnight struck, God killed all the Egyptian firstborn. We knew that from the Torah. As for those who were in the houses of the Israelites, so we find that at least some Israelites, we just learned, some Israelites brought their the Egyptian children in. Said, right, I want to go free. But that doesn't mean I want your child to die. I want your child to live. But God passed between the Israelites and the Egyptians, taking the life of the Egyptian and leaving the Israelite alive. The Jews woke up and found the Egyptian children dead amidst their families. As it says, I will pass over you and there will be no harm to you. So it turns out that the Jews were, only Jews were protected. Now stop the screen share for 1 second. So I just want to, what I want you to see here is that the Israelite parents disagree with God about who should die, right? If they agreed with God, they would have kept the Egyptian children out. They don't want the Egyptian children to die, but God does. I want to show you this image. This is a woodcut by Kathy Kollwitz of a circle of mothers protecting a group of children inside. Kollwitz lost her son, Peter, in World War I and became a pacifist and grieved her son's loss through a series of work. There's a small sculpture that's like this also. This is the image, right? This is the Israelites circling up, as it were, with the Egyptian parents to protect the children, Israelite and Egyptian alike, from the devastating force outside, who's not just an unnamed or evil army, but is in fact God, or the angel of death at God's behest. And I became familiar, I'll just share another name, with Kollwitz from Sarah Ruddick's book, Maternal Thinking, subject line Towards a Politics of Peace, where Ruddick thinks that there's something about deeply inhabiting maternal experience that makes one at least very reticent about war and perhaps a pacifist. And that's why Ruddick stands in the tradition of Kollwitz, and I want to suggest this midrash does also. And I just want you to see and feel here for a moment before we'll dial the tension down a bit, how stark what you see here is a voice of parental protest against divine violence, just like you know, and saying ultimately, the line you're drawing between Israelite and Egyptian isn't the only line that we inhabit. We are also caretakers of children. Full stop. And this violence that you're enacting in our name and on our behalf, we reject at least part of. It's an amazing, I mean, it's a devastating. And so that's why I'll just show, it's the same source here. You can see here, the Israelites began to sing at midnight, I arise to thank you, which is why it says, for all your righteous judgment. This is a verse from Psalm 119. At midnight, I arise to thank you for all your righteous judgments. So the picture here, right, the resolution is that the Israelites aren't sad, actually. They're singing. They're happy. They're praising God when they see these dead Egyptian children in sleeping bags and Samaritans. So I want to suggest there's two ways of reading this. The first is that we've saved God at the price of the characters of the Israelites becoming coherent in the story. What I mean by that, right? The same character would bring the child in wouldn't thank God for killing him, right? You can't. It's kind of like the book of Job, right? The textual problem tears the literary coherence apart. But there is one other possibility. I want to thank my friend Rabbi David Siegel, Iraq and Texas, for suggesting that this idea of praising God for all of God's righteous judgments is very evanescent of the bracha, Baruch Dayan Ha'emet, where you praise God even for the bad things that happen, even for striking down those we love. And it's a kind of bitter acknowledgement of the incontrovertibility of the divine will, even when it's against everything we want and believe in. And now we're getting in somewhere in the direction of what Ted was suggesting. I want to point out here, the voice of theological protest is very sharp and very great and uncompromising, right? We're not just into diversity, we're not just into plurality, but we're into real stark conflict. And also there's something very exciting about it. So I want to conclude with one word about this, and then just one word about the series. Both of these texts, I mentioned this earlier, these last two midrashim are from, one's from Devarim Rabbah, one's from Shemot Rabbah. Those are both Tanhuma family midrashim, which are late and heavily Babylonian. And the reason I'm mentioning that, I believe their book is called Arguing God. Dov Weiss's book, Arguing God, which has some really strong moments and some things it's left on the table, I think, tries to be a history of the idea of whether it's fundamentally pious to challenge God, like Job thought, or impious. One of the things that Weiss suggests is that the Mishnah is the most don't challenge God text in rabbinic literature, and the Tanhuma, from which we've just seen these two midrashim, is the most into challenging God as a fundamental act of piety, just like Abraham saying, right, the judge of the earth should not do justice. So I want to suggest a possibility, which is that the Mishnah, there's a correlation and maybe a causation between the fact that the Mishnah is not into challenging God, and the rabbis of the Mishnah were not into the theological and existential significance of being fathers, versus the Tanhuma, which we've, you know, Weiss has seen, we've just seen it here, is into challenging God. And we've also seen here is the most attuned text, much more than the Talmud, to the theological significance and existential significance of being a parent. And that perhaps, right, the less one is a parent, less one cares about God, the easier it is to be a yes man for God. And the more one deeply inhabits caring for a baby, the more likely you are to at some point be forced to confront God in protest. So we're done here, folks. You know, I hope what I've tried to do is throughout, and I hope this is doing, take those nagging fears, disappointments, the places where the things that we know to be true as human beings and the things we've been taught about Judaism don't match up or even in conflict with each other. And said, let's not keep trying to make them fit together. Let's actually like allow our feelings, thoughts, hope, fears, dreams, and convictions and experiences to breathe. And then look at the Torah and see what we find. And it turns out, I think a lot of the time we find things that we never could never have understood or appreciated because they were coming from that same troubled, concerned, playful place that we were. And here, I think, perhaps find the Torah that hasn't yet been written. That's why Feld's poem ends correctly in the subjunctive. You know, she wrote that circa 1980 before Mara Benjamin wrote her book, The Obligated Self, we talked about earlier. I only could write this piece and do this work because of Feld and Benjamin. And what it's like to write a new chapter of the tradition, which is in some ways such deep conflict with everything we've had so far, and in some ways is the path to opening up and realizing everything we've had so far.